Hi there, everyone. Happy Friday. It's 4 o'clock in New York at the end of what has been a momentous week in the investigations into the January 6th insurrection. In just the last hour, Stuart Rhodes, the head of the right-wing militia group, the Oath Keepers, was set to appear in court just one day after being charged with multiple counts in connection with the insurrection. Those include seditious conspiracy, which is the most serious charge levied against the more than 700 Capitol attack defendants. We will have more on that later in the broadcast, but we begin with the January 6th Select Committee entering uncharted waters as it grapples with what to do about the group of House Republicans allied with the disgraced ex-president who are intent on stonewalling the January 6th probe, a group that includes the leader of the House Republican caucus. One Kevin McCarthy. The New York Times reports this, quote, for weeks, members and investigators on the special House panel have privately agonized over how aggressive to be in pursuing sitting members of Congress, weighing their desire for information about lawmakers' direct interactions with former President Trump against the potential legal difficulty and political consequences of doing so. Now, they're wrestling with whether to subpoena McCarthy, the man who's in line to be speaker if Republicans retake the House this November, setting in motion a process that could potentially lead to a Democratic-controlled House holding him in contempt of Congress with the midterm elections looming. Congressional investigators have rarely confronted a situation that carries such hefty stakes for their institution. It's a situation with hefty stakes for their investigation as well, given McCarthy's many conversations and meetings with the ex-president, and given that questions are mounting about what was said during those interactions. Just days after the insurrection, Kevin McCarthy told a local California radio host in an interview he probably does not want to remind people about because it represents the starkest departure from his current role as Donald Trump's human shield. In this interview, he says that the former president admitted bearing some responsibility for the attack on the Capitol. Listen.
I say he has responsibility. He told me personally that he does have some responsibility. I think a lot of people do. But now that I find out, and the one thing about impeachment, why would you run it through so fast? I say let's put a bipartisan commission. Let's learn all the facts.
So remember that it was McCarthy, though, who later opposed all those things. He rounded up, he whipped votes in opposition to a bipartisan commission that one of his own deputies negotiated. But it's this question of what Trump tells McCarthy in the aftermath of the insurrection that's of interest to the committee. And McCarthy seems to be doing everything in his power to avoid telling them. Here's what he said at his weekly press conference yesterday.
In the spirit of disclosing private conversations, did you tell House Republicans on a January 11th phone call that President Trump told you he agreed that he bore some responsibility for January 6th, as Chairman Thompson's letter indicates?
I'm not sure what call you're talking about.
The January 6th Select Committee grappling with the obstruction of the House GOP leader is where we start this hour. Betsy Woodruff Swann is here. She's a national correspondent for Politico, as well as an MSNBC contributor. Also joining us, former Republican strategist Steve Schmidt. And Congresswoman Madeleine Dean of Pennsylvania joins us. She's a member of the House Judiciary Committee. Congresswoman, I start with you. What do you think happened to Kevin McCarthy between his answers to a local radio station in his district that are consistent with his January 10th floor speech, and this sort of posture of either forgetting or lying about those communications and contacts?
Well, good to be with you and your panelists. I don't know what happened to him, but it reminds me of my old law school days when we learned of an exception to the hearsay rule known as excited utterance. Meaning that when you say something in the moment of trauma, in the moment of an accident, whatever it happens to be, that can rise above hearsay. What we heard from Mr. McCarthy in the hours following the insurrection, in that interview just days following, were excited utterances revealing the truth. And so what I think has happened is he retreated. Of course, he met with former President Trump, retreated because he has decided not to uphold his oath, that he is more interested in power, more interested in protecting lies and possible conspiracies, and not interested in upholding his oath. I think that is what has happened here.
So don't take our word for it, though. Let's play some more of Kevin McCarthy in his own words in this window where you're describing witnesses can sometimes be more truthful. It's again from this interview on January 13th, 2021, where he talks about working out a censure agreement for Donald Trump with Steny Hoyer. Listen.
Is it true that you went to Steny Hoyer and tried to work out a censure agreement?
Yes.
So then you feel that the president is responsible for what happened.
I feel he has some responsibility. That's why I think censure rises to that level. But is he?
But it's not impeachable? It's not an impeachable offense?
He did not say go in. I don't know. I don't believe it's an impeachable offense.
Clearly a very different Kevin McCarthy emerged after this interview and after the January 10th floor speech. Do you think the committee should examine whether something along the lines of witness tampering took place during that meeting in Mar-a-Lago or in previous phone conversations between the ex-president and McCarthy?
Well, I think that's exactly some of the issues that the committee is looking at. They want to get the facts. So what is Mr. McCarthy afraid of? The facts. What did he know in advance of the attack? What did he know during the attack? What was his conversation with the president during the attack as he called upon the president, as reported, to do something, to speak out? Could you imagine any other Republican president, even if not responsible for the attack itself, sitting there for 187 minutes? Picture Ronald Reagan sitting in the dining room for 187 minutes as the Capitol and his own vice president were under attack. Mr. McCarthy is calculating. He is cowardice. He should uphold his oath and do his patriotic duty and just tell the truth. Tell the truth if someone tried to tamper with your memory of what happened or the records of what happened. I have great confidence, as you know, in this committee to get at the truth. And so the words coming out of both sides of Mr. McCarthy's mouth are not persuasive. His blistering statement following the committee asking him to come in and testify has no burn because he has no credibility.
There's also so much in the public record, Betsy, that we know already. And Steny Hoyer today confirms that it was McCarthy who proposed a censure agreement with him. He said this to CNN, quote, he was looking at options because at that point he was holding the president responsible. Here's the timeline that we've been able to assemble, again, from the public-facing Kevin McCarthy. January 6th, Trump tells McCarthy, quote, well, Kevin, I guess these people are more upset about the election than you are. The source is a statement produced during the impeachment trial by Representative Jamie Herrera Butler. On January 11th, McCarthy tells the House GOP that Trump has accepted some responsibility for the attack. That was first reported in Politico. And then this period of sort of recognizing Trump's culpability abruptly ends on January 28th when McCarthy meets with Trump at Mar-a-Lago. What is your understanding, Betsy, of the committee's interest in putting together what intervention may have taken place there or before that?
They're interested in McCarthy's conversations and the conversations of Trump aides both before, during, and after January 6th. They want to get a complete picture in large part because they want to know exactly what the president's mindset was, what his intents were as the attack was unfolding, as well as any steps that he could have taken in the aftermath of the attack to try to continue to engage in election denialism and to start trying to do the work of reputation rehabilitation. That's a key focus for the Select Committee. One thing that's really consequential in a weird way about one of the proposals that McCarthy had and then jettisoned. One of the proposals he had was to have a bipartisan commission. You heard that in the audio that you just played. The fact was, which is really kind of funny looking back, is that the negotiations for a bipartisan commission, there was a deal reached between John Katko, a House Republican who's just announced he's retiring, and congressional Democrats that would have set up a bipartisan commission. That commission's work would have ended on New Year's Eve of last year. If McCarthy had agreed to go forward with that commission instead of whipping against it, then the official congressional investigation into January 6th would have gotten way less information than the other official now operating congressional investigation into January 6th. By opposing that commission, the alternative that emerged is a commission that's entirely composed of members who are really concerned about Trump, and that's going to be run for much longer than it would have, resulting in a lot more information for the public. The challenge, of course, now for this congressional committee is deciding what to do about McCarthy. There's one thing that I can say with almost 100% degree of confidence, and that I'm sure members of this committee are aware of as well, and that is that Kevin McCarthy is all but certain not to cooperate voluntarily whatsoever. If they're going to try to get him to cooperate, a subpoena is the only tool that they have. The question is just whether or not they're comfortable trying to use that tool.
Steve Schmidt, let me show you what Congressman Adam Schiff, who is on the Select Committee, had to say about Kevin McCarthy.
But now we have McCarthy and others refusing to do their duty. The way I look at it, we have certain remedies potentially with McCarthy, with Perry, with Jordan, with other House members that we don't have with a Steve Bannon, for example, or Mark Meadows. That is because the House can control its own members, can discipline its own members. So there are other options than the criminal contempt route. We haven't decided on what options to use, but there is an ability of the House to essentially police its own that we'll have to consider.
Steve Schmidt, no one's ever accused Kevin McCarthy of being good at strategery. And Betsy's point about whipping up opposition to the CATCo deal that I believe succeeded in meeting all the requirements that House Republican leadership set out to meet in that bipartisan commission. They wanted joint authority, bipartisan authority, and sign off over all subpoenas. CATCo achieved that. They wanted it outside of Congress. CATCo achieved that. And they wanted it to sunset, basically, at the end of the year, and CATCo achieved that. Nonetheless, Steve Scalise and Kevin McCarthy whipped votes against it after John CATCo came back from those successful negotiations. And here we are with the House Select Committee, including two Republicans who know exactly who Kevin McCarthy is, what he did, and what he knows.
Kevin McCarthy has become, and this is an extraordinary thing for me to say personally, because I met Kevin McCarthy before he was a member of Congress, when he was the minority leader in the California legislature. As you know, Nicole, Sacramento is a small town. And what Kevin McCarthy has become is this villainous figure that is among the most villainous figures that have been in the history of the American Republic. He has played a profoundly important role over this last year through the lying, through the cover-up of poisoning faith and belief in democracy. And one of the things about Kevin McCarthy, if you watch him operate, is that he's very childlike in that he lives entirely in the moment. He's not thinking about the ramifications for the next conversation based on what he's saying in the current or in the last. He's just trying to survive. He's trying to survive in the moment. So in that moment, Kevin McCarthy was reading the situation. He understood how egregious this was. And in the end, before he gets down to Mar-a-Lago, which was fundamentally about securing the financing pipeline for the House Republicans in the 2020 midterms, that's what that meeting was substantially about. We have Kevin McCarthy at the center of this. He's always been at the center of it, continues to be at the center of it, and the House should use every power that it has at its discretion, including an inherent contempt power that could see the sergeant of arms handcuff and detain Kevin McCarthy in a locked basement office until he wishes to testify. There is no matter before the country that's more serious than this one. And being minority leader, being the leader of Republicans, does not immunize you either from your duty or to complying with lawful subpoenas. You certainly don't have the right, because of that political title, to obstruct an investigation into a murderous insurrection and attack on the processes of electing and inaugurating the president of the United States.
Congresswoman, it's not a perfect analogy, but over in the Senate, we see Democrats really wrestling with how to use their power and not able to muster all the Democrats to put aside the filibuster to protect the right to vote from the 400 proposed, 19 passed voter restriction laws, voter nullification measures. The House seems to be in a different place, and again, in a very different context, but in this investigation into the insurrection itself and the events leading up to it, they have the bipartisan approach. They have the bipartisan buy-in. They have Liz Cheney, who is not just a vocal critic of the Republican caucus, but basically an informant of what went on and what was said, and Adam Kinzinger. They know exactly what Kevin McCarthy was communicating to the caucus, because until Kevin McCarthy purged Liz Cheney from his leadership ranks, she was on his team, and she didn't quit his team. He pushed her. He threw her off it. He muttered under his breath on a hot mic at Fox News he was going to do it. And then, as Steve said, living in the moment and whatever positive feedback he got, he pushed her out. What is the responsibility that this bipartisan select committee has to use that sort of bipartisan spirit of getting to the truth no matter the consequences and do some of these incredibly historic, perhaps incredibly difficult things like subpoenaing the Republican leader?
I think we do have an obligation. The committee is moving swiftly as well. I hope they will use every tool at their disposal in a patriotic way and in a truth-finding way. You know, last week we marked the one-year anniversary, I thought, in a series of very thoughtful ways on January the 6th. And one of the things that we did was a moment of silence in the chamber. And you saw the striking picture of the Democratic side quite busy and occupied with those who wanted to mark that moment of silence, and standing alone on the Republican side, no other Republicans but Liz Cheney and her father, Dick Cheney. We wound up lining up to go up and say hello, and I to just continue to support Liz in her work and to speak with the vice president to say how proud he must be of her. But it felt like a strange funeral. There was no body there. There was no Kevin McCarthy there. This is the institution of our democracy, and how they couldn't bring themselves to mark that day. As John Meacham said later in the day, as he and Doris Kearns Goodwin had such a wonderful, reassuring historical presentation for us, he said a little bit with tongue in cheek, he said, for the politicians in the room, you all think about your portrait. In the end of the day, you all think you'll wind up in a portrait. And what will you want that portrait to reveal? I think Steve and you and these facts, Mr. McCarthy's own words, will paint a very sad portrait for all of history. And I say that to say to Mr. McCarthy, it's not too late. Come forward. Do your patriotic duty. Realize that you are taking yourself and your party down a rabbit hole of lies and cult-like behavior. And it will not end well. It will not end well for us as a country, and it will not end well for your party. It's not too late. Do the patriotic thing. Come voluntarily before this committee to protect our democracy.
Steve, I'm going to come back to you. You worked for the Cheney family, and I have to hear from you on what the congresswoman's describing on the anniversary of the insurrection itself. But Betsy, I want to ask you, I've heard of some of the members who were in contact with the ex-president who are sure to be of interest to the committee lawyering up. And I wonder if Kevin McCarthy has changed legal strategy, since there's so much Kevin McCarthy in the public space that seems to contradict the Kevin McCarthy of 2022.
That's a good question. I haven't been asking folks about whether or not McCarthy's legal strategy has changed. My sense is that he's moving forward ahead and hasn't really telegraphed any concerns about the fact that the committee has now asked him to participate in their investigation. The statement that he put out, of course, very much speaks for itself. And the perspective that I would expect that he will embrace, which is sort of the general consensus in the broader Republican legal community, is that the select committee's leverage leverage over McCarthy is limited. Most Republican lawyers, especially folks who are on, you know, Team McCarthy, Team Trump, would say that what they're able to do, what the committee is able to do, is just not particularly robust. Of course, that may not be the case. It has yet to be tested. At this point, the next big question, I think, before I would expect to be seeing some sort of changed strategy in McCarthy's space, is whether the Select Committee telegraphs that it actually will take the very sort of muscular and aggressive step of issuing a subpoena to try to compel McCarthy to participate in their investigation. If all that the committee does to try to get McCarthy to cooperate is just this letter that, frankly, in very respectful language, asks him politely to participate in their probe, if that's the totality of it, then I don't think that's something that's going to give McCarthy or his allies in broader House Republican leadership much anxiety going forward. The ball is very much in the Select Committee's court right now. And as the Times reporting that we looked at the top highlights, they haven't decided firmly on their next step. It's a tough call.
Steve, I'm a student of patterns. I know you are, too. This committee at every fork in the road has chosen so far the more muscular approach. It's not to say they will with McCarthy. But if you put Liz Cheney and Kevin McCarthy in a game of chicken, I know who's going to blink first, and it is not Liz Cheney. But I also want your thoughts on where the committee stands in terms of that single subpoena and of what the Congresswoman's describing, a single Republican in the House Republican ranks in the building, in the Capitol, to honor the men and women of law enforcement. I believe four have died by suicide since that day. Officer Sicknick died from injuries a couple days after the insurrection, and not one of them thought to be in the building that day.
In a moment of silence, we hear one of the loudest declarations in the history of our country from the floor of the United States Congress, when we see the accumulation of malice and indecency, a lust for power above principle, above the Constitution, above the Republic, with the absence of the whole of the Republican Party. And when you think about the Capitol of the United States, I think it is the most breathtakingly beautiful building in the United States. It is the building in America that rivals any in the world, any across Europe, for its beauty. And that dome represents the greatest act of optimism in American history. When Abraham Lincoln insisted during Civil War that that building be completed, that that dome be reconstructed, so government of the people, by the people, for the people, that government that had survived this terrible bloodletting of the Civil War, that government would reconsecrate under that dome. And to see the Confederate flag carried across the rotunda, the fact that these insurrectionists defecated in the halls, urinated on the walls, that they tore the place apart, it was an assault on each and every one of us. And Dick Cheney, at his core, is a man of the house. He revered the institution. And so what he did that morning is he asserted his prerogatives as a former member. He came across the river from Virginia and he stood there because, as he said, this was a historic event. And it was. And everything that is playing out now in America around the remembrance of this event is about a predictable moment ahead when a Republican candidate, and it will be a Republican candidate for president, loses the election but declares themselves to be the winner and has an infrastructure prepared to back him up in the states and in the counties and try to seize from the winner the reins of power in the oldest democratic republic on the planet. We are at a crucial, important, and historic hour in this country.
Betsy Woodruff Swan, Congresswoman Madeleine Dean, thank you so much for starting us off. Steve, sticking around. When we come back, the leader of the Oath Keepers is in court in the last hour facing charges of seditious conspiracy. The latest on that and how these charges have upended the right-wing talking point that this insurrection was not an insurrection at all. Plus, Republican obstructionism has finally rammed its way into the White House, giving the president a series of setbacks this week. What the administration's reset might look like as it prepares itself for year two. That's ahead. Later in the program, the GOP assault on democracy shows no signs of slowing from Georgia to Wisconsin to Michigan. We'll look at where the fight to preserve free and fair elections goes next. All those stories and more when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Stay with us. Stuart Rhodes, leader of the extremist group The Oath Keepers, making his first court appearance this afternoon in Texas after being arrested and charged with seditious conspiracy, along with 10 other members and associates of that organization. Charges that have, in real time now, dealt a crushing blow to a major narrative, a key talking point in right-wing media on and about the January 6th insurrection. As our friend Aaron Blake reports in today's Washington Post, quote, for months, those who have sought to downplay the Capitol riot decided to cite the lack of such criminal charges as some kind of proof that January 6th wasn't all that bad. Charges like sedition and conspiracy, for example. Here are just a few of those instances from Fox News that Aaron Blake cites in his reporting, dating all the way back to last May. Watch.
Oh, it was an insurrection. So how many of the participants in that insurrection have been charged with insurrecting, with sedition, with treason? Zero.
No one has been charged with sedition or insurrection. Most have been hit with charges like parading. Parading. Who knew that was a crime? By the way, it should be. I hate parades.
How many times have you heard all those buzzwords used in the press just in the last few days? But here's a question. How many times do words like insurrection, sedition, or treason appear in Biden's own DOJ indictments against the January 6th rioters? The answer, zero.
I'll always wonder what she was actually texting when I see her on TV. We checked in, though, on her program. That was Laura Ingraham and Tucker Carlson's last night to see how those seditious conspiracy charges blew up. Did they lead with them? Did it change their analysis of whether January 6th was an insurrection or not? We'll cut to the chase here. They did not. Instead, those hosts we showed you portrayed the DOJ as caving to political pressure rather than, for example, responding to overwhelming evidence presented in the indictments. Like Stuart Rhodes' own words in writing on November 5th of 2020, he wrote this, quote, we aren't getting through this without a civil war. Too late for that. Prepare your mind, body, spirit. It's worth noting this is the second major right-wing talking point on the insurrection to fall just this week, to be upended by facts and evidence. On Tuesday, the January 6th Select Committee debunked the very popular, buzzy conspiracy theory that a man named Ray Epps, a rioter seen egging on protesters on January 5th of last year, was actually a federal agent. Joining us now, Harry Lipman, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General and former U.S. Attorney. Steve Schmidt is back with us. Harry, I'm reminded of that, I think, the cliche that a lie gets all the way around the world before the truth sort of gets out of bed and gets dressed. I mean, that seems to be the danger of this really sort of hyper disinformation on steroids, amplified echo chamber that permeates the minds of everyone in that sort of MAGA base before the slow and opaque investigation that DOJ undertakes before charging something like seditious conspiracy can take place.
Exactly. By the way, it was always a very weak talking point. Mitch McConnell said on the floor, this was a failed insurrection. Trump's lawyer in impeachment says everyone agrees it was a violent insurrection. The very resolution you just brought up that they all voted for called it an insurrection. So it was a dog always that wouldn't hunt. But yes, anyone who knows DOJ would know that that's what it means to be building methodically. They've had these crimes of property and peace, and they now really have anchored the investigation with what we all saw on January 6th, an attack on the country, an attack on the rule of law, an attack on the peaceful transfer of power. It's a really significant indictment.
Harry, I want to read from the indictment in Rhodes' own words. On December 22nd, 2020, in an interview with a regional Oath Keepers leader, Rhodes stated that if President-elect Biden were able to assume the presidency, quote, we will have to do a bloody, massively bloody revolution against them. That's what's going to have to happen. How much in sort of going through the indictment do you see the case pieced together from inside the organization, from Rhodes' own words and from, I believe there are four people that seem to be indicated as cooperating?
Yeah, it's very strong. And you've named the two pillars of evidence. They got all these texts and were able to decode them. And of course, they're cooperators. These are really serious charges, Nicole, and it's the kind of leverage to make people turn. I just want to say one point. This is absolutely the right charge, because what they were doing was hindering the execution of the law, which is how the indictment puts it. It's a hard charge and a rare charge in history, but it doesn't have to be the case that, like, the Citadel was shaking and they were about to have a successful revolution. The point is, and this has come up in the previous successful indictments, is that they were really going at the law itself. They were hindering, delaying the execution of the law. So this fits it to a T. It's actually just like an episode not that many people know about in the 50s where Puerto Rican nationalists were on the floor of the Senate. It wasn't the case that the Republic was about to fall. It was the case that they were seditionists. They were insurrectionists because they were trying to hinder the law itself.
Steve Schmidt, what is the point? Where was the fracture where Fox News editorially feels compelled to defend seditious insurrection?
It's a terrific question. It's an immoral answer in that what they're doing is assaulting the fabric of the world's greatest democratic republic, the oldest one. They are very much undermining faith and belief in American democracy. The reason they are doing it, I think, is the most obvious one, is for money. There is a billion-dollar audience that's out there that can now be more easily imprisoned intellectually, algorithmically, where they are consigned to these information silos where a community forms. And I think a lot of people, particularly in COVID or lonely, are sitting at home searching for a sense of connection, for a sense of community. What spews forth on Fox trickles down to the Facebook posts and chat rooms and to the level where this fills people's feeds within their groups. And they have a community that has opted out of reality. And the people responsible for it aren't the victims of the misinformation. It's the people that are peddling the lies and the BS. And in this case, what's so significant to me about these charges is that in American society over the last 20 years, in a way that has destabilized American democracy, is that all of the accountability we see in society is inflicted at the bottom rung of the ladder. Great example of this is the economic crisis in 2009. Tens of millions of families lose their homes, lose their mortgages. What Wall Street banker went to jail? The answer is none of them. So what we see in this prosecution now is that, no, it's not just going to be the schmo who invaded the Capitol and did whatever desecration. It's going to be the leaders of the paramilitary movement. It's going to be the leader of the extremist movement, that this is going to go up the ladder. And that's a rare change in American society and culture over the last 20 years, and no doubt one that is alarming a lot of members of Congress and other people who think their position of power immunizes them from accountability, even when it's the most grievous sins that you could commit against the Republic.
Harry, as we watch this case go forward, what are you watching for? Who will prosecute this case? Just tell us sort of what to watch for next.
Yeah, so this very one will be handled out of the local U.S. attorney's office. I'll really be watching who comes on the stand and what they say. It's a kind of petty satisfaction of a former prosecutor to see a organization crack and somebody come forward and talk. But what I'll really be looking for is whether the department is going to marry this up to, as Steve says, we are now at the planning stage, and we're also, of course, at the attack on law stage. It's possible, we don't know, but that it certainly stands to reason that the Rhodeses of the world weren't the only planners, that political officials were. So I want to see if they put together two more conspiracies. One would involve the sort of Roger Stone, Steve Bannons of the world, the kind of bridge between the ragtag and the political officials. And the ultimate one would be at the White House level itself. Not saying they have it, but that's what I'll be looking for them to try to put together.
We will be calling on both of you as we all watch to see if that's in the cards. Wow. Harry Lipman, Steve Schmidt, thank you both so much for spending some time with us today. Next up for us, the White House trying to take a less than ideal week of headlines and turn the page to focus on some of their year one accomplishments. Our political panel on how the president can remain on track.
There's a lot of talk about disappointments and things we haven't gotten done. We're going to get a lot of them done, I might add.
President Biden there trying to strike a hopeful tone earlier today as he made remarks highlighting the progress that he has made on his infrastructure bill passed last year. The president announcing that he will distribute billions of dollars to repair and replace thousands of bridges all across the country. Also today, NBC News is reporting that the president will sign a series of executive actions as early as this month on police reform as a way to help excite and re-energize the coalition that voted him into office and to make waves on an issue that has high public support. The White House and the president trying to turn the page as they head into their one-year anniversary. He will mark that anniversary with a press conference next Wednesday, I believe in this hour, just his second solo press conference since taking office. Let's bring into our conversation the Reverend Al Sharpton, host of MSNBC's Politics Nation and the president of the National Action Network. Also joining us, Donnie Deutsch, host of the podcast On Brand, and Jonathan Lemire, White House Bureau Chief for Politico, host of MSNBC's Way Too Early, as well as an MSNBC political analyst. You know, I see the evidence of this hyper-polarized moment, Jonathan, in the fact that a lot of viewers of our programs don't like anything that goes wrong for this president to be covered. You know, that you're piling on, you're being unfair to him, being unfair to Merrick Garland. I'm sure you see evidence of that, too. But in the sort of fact-attached America, it's a whole different reality altogether. I wonder what you make of how this White House has sort of assessed the landscape and the politics when you're in.
Nicole, there's no question, whether it's on my Twitter feed or responses to the show, it's right. People, you know, don't like it sometimes if we are reporting or writing something that might be perceived as critical of the president. We're just telling them what happened. This White House recognizes they're in a bit of a low moment, and it's sort of been a tale of two half years for President Biden. The first 6 months in office went about as well as you could. They methodically unveiled and distributed the vaccine. They got the COVID relief bill passed. They returned a sense of normalcy to Washington after the 4 years of tumult that was Donald Trump. There was a sense here that the government was working again. And no doubt some of that has persisted. An infrastructure bill passed now into law is a major accomplishment, too. But the back half of the year, which sort of began last summer with the Delta surge, which caught the White House, they acknowledge, off guard, the tumultuous withdrawal from Afghanistan, and now legislative failures with Build Back Better Act, that's put on pause. And at least for now, it doesn't seem like anything's really going anywhere on voting rights either. It's a tough moment, but they feel like they've got a good story to tell.
They want to highlight those accomplishments. And also, they just want to say they want to put forth the idea that things will get better, that this Omicron wave hopefully will fade in the next few weeks. The vaccine and boosters are still available for anyone who wants it. Money is going to bridges and highways. They are going to try to push again on voting rights as best they can. They think inflation will hopefully start to go down come spring, summer. And they feel like voters will recognize that come midterms.
Donnie, when I worked in politics, you can become captive to this idea that if you keep chasing the cheese, you'll catch it and you'll be able to fix your principal's political problems. And lots of principals have that belief. It's been captured in Aaron Sorkin scripts as well. If I pass the crime bill, if I pass Build Back Better. My sense is that that's happening up here and maybe the country's over here. The country is feeling extreme anxiety about inflation. The country is feeling despair about everything directly and tangentially related to and a fallout from the pandemic. And the country's almost lost its grip on any sort of shared vocabulary about who we are and what we want. And the other side isn't just wrong, they're evil. What can this president do that is not something that he has to turn over control to Congress to, that is not something he has to pray that a virus does differently than a virus is going to do? I mean, what is in his power to change next week as he heads into sort of this one-year reframing?
Great question, Nicole. Your question was kind of teeing up where I was going to go. I don't think a lot of this is left-brain stuff. I think it's right-brain stuff. And I think your audience is not going to be happy with what I have to say is, I don't think he's come across as an inspirational figure. I don't think, by the way, I could give a litany of things he's accomplished, and obviously, and Jonathan Lemire laid out things that have not gone well for him. But there's something else different. How many people do you talk to when they say, he seems old? And I don't mean that as an ageist thing. He doesn't, and it really started with Afghanistan, where he just didn't seem to have his hand firmly on the wheel. And I think a lot of this has to do with the messenger versus the messages itself. He doesn't feel in charge. He doesn't feel inspirational. He doesn't feel in command. And part of it is he's just done less pressers than any other president. So this audience is not going to like to hear it. But if I'm just kind of judging on style points and I'm judging on performance, he has not come across as a firm, strong commander-in-chief. Just overall, if I'm grading him, as I said, it's not going to be a popular statement. It's the way I feel.
Rev, what should he be focused on in the coming days and weeks?
I think he must continue to focus on what he's going to deal with the voting rights issue. Even if it's voted down, how is he going to deal with that? He certainly needs to deal with policing, and he certainly needs to deal with even with the BBB, Build Back Better, how that's going to affect people on the ground. I think that he has made some concrete moves. I would have put voting rights first and done other things, but he has accomplished some concrete things. The two things I think that was a disconnect between the White House and even their own base, the coalition that put him there, is that what they focused on may not be the immediate things that the coalition that got around him or that surrounded and brought him to victory, what they were focused on. People were concerned about voting. And what is not the president's fault, but is his circumstance, 19 states changed voting laws while it happened, while he was talking infrastructure, what took some of the lust out of infrastructure, which was very important. But it seemed like, wait a minute, it's like somebody is hurting me and you're talking about how I gave you a good, healthy meal to eat when somebody has bruised my arm. So I think the disconnect was the passion that they had in the White House didn't match the passion of some of their electorate. I think he's beginning to catch up with that. But I think that sometimes you have to read your audience before you get up and try to address them. It could be a magnificent oratory. I'm a preacher. It could be a great sermon. But if the audience is into something else, you're talking to yourself.
Yeah, we're going to talk about this more. The Rev teed this up perfectly. And Rev, you were in Atlanta with the president and vice president Tuesday. We're going to talk about what went wrong with what is now not just existential for the Democratic base and President Biden's coalition, but the country. That's next.
We'll be right back.
The Rev was in Georgia Tuesday for President Biden's big speech on voting rights, an issue the White House is hoping will help define his legacy. We're back with the Rev, Donnie and Jonathan. Rev, what are your conversations with this White House about where that issue stands sound like? What's going on behind the scenes that even keeps this alive since it doesn't seem to have any legislative future?
I think that the White House, the conversations I've had there and after, is committed to trying to make sure that there is some way that they get this voting rights bill through. I wish they had started a lot earlier. I wish it had been more public, but we are where we are. But they seem determined. I think the president made a very passionate speech. I think he came with a real strong analysis of where we are. We're talking about voting rights in 2022. In Martin Luther King weekend, that many people felt we had solved this in the 60s. I remember in 2006, there was a president that signed the renewing of the Voting Rights Act. He invited us to the White House for the signing on the lawn. I was on the first row, invited by Karl Rove. His name was George Bush. And
there.
All of the Republicans that had voted for that. So I'm sitting there looking at Biden saying, what is so strange about a voting rights act? George Bush, who I've fought on many issues, as you know, Nicole, from Katrina on, invited me, called me out at 2006. And we're sitting here, what, 14, 15 years later, talking about this with states changing the laws. I think that that's what has to go forward. And I must say this, for Senator Sinema to time her announcing she would not vote for the rule when the president was getting in the car to come over and meet with them, I think was something that was very unnecessary and very offensive to many of us that wanted this voting rights discussion by the president with the Democratic Senate. Why would you time your doing that when you know the president was on his way to the Capitol to talk and discuss this? I think that that kind of things is what has many of us concerned, if not angered, that they are not taking our fundamental right to protect our vote seriously. It's one thing to disagree with me. It's another thing to hold me in a contemptible manner.
We're going to put a pin in this today, but I'm going to have all of you back on Monday as you're available to have the second part of this. What does he do? I mean, what from sort of within the coalition and from the smartest sort of minds in his coalition, how do you turn it around? He's 1 year in, and as Jonathan said, there are a lot of accomplishments to tout, but there's a lot of frustration, as the Rev has pointed out. The Reverend Al Sharpton, Donnie Deutsch, Jonathan Lemire, thank you for spending some time with us. I'm sorry it was so short. The next hour of Deadline White House starts after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
We represent a state where, as in many, laws have been passed and further laws are being offered which would selectively disenfranchise voters, give partisan officials the power to subvert elections. The United States Senate needs to act to defend the sacred franchise and the integrity of American elections. We have the constitutional authority to do so. We cannot hide from history at this moment.
Hi again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in New York. Almost no one understands and appreciates the need to pass federal voting rights legislation better than the man you just heard from, as well as the man standing by his side. Those are the two Democratic senators from Georgia, the state that played a major role in President Joe Biden's win and elected both of them to office, giving Democrats majority in the Senate. In the wake of those key victories, Republicans in Georgia pushed and passed a restrictive voting law that was so bad, Major League Baseball moved its all-star game out of the state because of it. And brand new reporting shows that Republicans are not done yet in Georgia. Republicans there are continuing their assault on elections in 2022. With even more proposals, more restrictions. The New York Times describes how the leader of the Georgia State Senate is, quote, promoting a new measure to prohibit the use of drop boxes for absentee ballots, which he says would increase security. though no problems with their use by voters have been verified. The Times goes on to list those other provisions. Quote, one measure under consideration would allow Georgians to use paper ballots if they have concerns about the recently purchased touch screen voting machines that were the subject of fantastical fraud claims promulgated by some of Trump's supporters. Another proposal would allow the Georgia Bureau of Investigation to open inquiries into allegations of voter fraud. Yet another would create a constitutional amendment to prevent non-citizens from voting, even though they are already barred from voting under existing state law. Limits on access to the right to vote are not just happening in Georgia. Yesterday in Wisconsin, a circuit court judge ruled that absentee ballot drop boxes are not allowed under Wisconsin law. It's a ruling that could potentially remove an option for voting ahead of that state's crucial midterm elections. Let us repeat for the record, there was no widespread voter fraud that any of these provisions pretend to address, especially when it comes to drop boxes. But to Republicans who exist in this post-truth chamber, the facts don't matter. It's all about doing whatever they can do to grab and keep power. Take this story out of Florida. Despite only getting less than 20% of the vote in a race for a U.S. House seat earlier this week, Republican candidate Jason Mariner said this, quote, now they called the race. I did not win, so they say. But that does not mean that they lost either. It does not mean that we lost. What? Yes, it does. That's how it works. You got so many fewer votes. You lost. But here we are. The supporters of the big lie install more and more loyalists, more and more post-fact Republicans into positions of power and enact new laws that facilitate the subversion of elections. What happens to the candidates who don't accept their defeat? The Boston Globe contemplates that question. They write this, quote, while few would suggest that Mariner will be in Congress in this year, his refusal to concede and decision to file a lawsuit raises an interesting question about the boundaries of American democracy. What if a partisan judge rules without facts in favor of a soundly defeated candidate for office? If that seems implausible, then what about for closer elections? The urgent need to guard against the Republican Party's undemocratic push to control and subvert elections is where we start this hour with some of our favorite reporters and friends. New York Times domestic correspondent Nick Corsonides back. Also joining us, Greg Bluestone, reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And Cliff Albright is here, executive director of the Black Voters Matter Fund. Nick, we've talked so much about this Georgia law. I think you first started coming on this show when you were writing about it and reporting out how many people would be impacted. What was left? What are these state leaders doing? What are they going after?
Well, you know, they clearly took aim back in March at drop boxes. Those were, expanded during the 2020 election to give voters who didn't necessarily have confidence in the Postal Service a more secure way of dropping off their ballots. And they were 24/7. There were, I think, 38 around Fulton County alone, giving voters a very easy way of bringing back their ballot. And it was used by a ton of voters in this very Democratic county. I think it was over 50%. So the law back in March took aim at that and reduced those from 38 to the single digits in Fulton County alone. Now they're looking to eliminate them completely. And I think it just kind of shows that what a lot of these voting laws have done, and especially in Georgia, is they looked at the voting patterns that changed in 2020. And they saw how what was once, a law that was passed in 2005 to allow no excuse absentee voting by mail for more rural Republican voters had suddenly been embraced by Democratic voters more in urban areas. So this new proposal by the top Republican in the Senate in Georgia is looking to get rid of those drop boxes completely. In another way to kind of further limit the absentee voting that has been more embraced by Democrats. Now, I've been told that it's not necessarily guaranteed to progress, and Ralston, who's the speaker, hasn't necessarily said, like, I'm for this. But there's other elements, too, that they're looking for, including an investigative force, which, you know, both Governor Ron DeSantis has spoken about and other Republicans around the country, looking to kind of bring more of that law enforcement heft to investigating elections. And again, as you said at the outset, elections that haven't seen any fraud. So what Democrats say is this is just a chilling effect and trying to scare people from voting. So while the Georgia law in March was so sweeping, there's still new elements and I think new things that we're going to see both in Georgia and around the country that are going to further look to add new limits to voting and mess with election administration as well.
Greg Bluestein, there's no evidence that the Republicans crafting these laws, these measures, are targeting fraud. Is there? I mean, they seem to be targeting what Nick's talking about, Democratic turnout. What is the pushback? What is the response from the Democrats?
Well, the Democrats are saying that the big lie still has big influence in Georgia Republican politics. And by the way, it's not just Democrats pushing back on this. It's also some senior Republicans who worry that the Republican candidates are focusing too much on 2020, relitigating last year, 2 years ago's election, and not enough on 2022. And as a result, we've seen a lot of these proposals designed to rally Trump supporters by playing into these lies, even if they have very little chance of passing. And as Nick mentioned, there's not much appetite to pass this ban on ballot drop boxes. Even the governor said he has no real inclination to revisit these laws. But the very fact that one of the most powerful Republicans in the Georgia legislature is bringing this legislation to help further his campaign for lieutenant governor kind of says it all.
Greg, we covered, and I think we've all talked when the decision was made by Major League Baseball, far from the most political of professional sports leagues, moved its game out of Georgia. It wasn't really followed, though, by a wave of subsequent boycotts, and the pressure seemed to come off. But the efforts to make it harder to vote and to really target Democratic strongholds seem to be turbocharged. Is it all the big lie? Is it all this belief that Trump's coming back? I mean, what drives that?
You know, polls and from the AJC and other outlets of Georgia Republican voters still show that the big lie has taken root. And even candidates who are more mainstream, like Butch Miller, the candidate we were just talking about, who proposed the ballot drop box ban, he is seen as an establishment Republican, but he also did not win Donald Trump's endorsement. So he has to feel right now that he's got to support these sort of far right plays into conspiracy theories in order to win a Republican primary against someone, a fellow state senator who is backed by Donald Trump. And that's just the scenario we're facing throughout Georgia is we've got a number of candidates who feel like they've got to move further to the right to combat Trump-backed candidates. Trump has now endorsed four candidates in statewide races in Georgia, and he's likely to weigh in on a few others before the May primary is out.
Cliff, Trump is like long COVID, right? Even after you think you've beaten it, it's still manifesting itself in really troubling and in some instances inexplicable symptoms and disease. And in this case, the Trump tail is it's not just extreme politics. It's not policy debates. I mean, what Greg has been covering, what Nick has reported on, is an attempt to rig the electorate. How does the other side create the more vast and the more politically potent coalition to combat that?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Nicole. I mean, part of it is that, you know, we do what we've been doing for the past year, which is fighting for a federal voting rights legislation, because we know at the end of the day, no matter what organizing that we do, if we don't have federal protections against some of this stuff, then, you know, it's but so much mobilization you can do when you got some people who, as you said, don't recognize that there's really only two options. You either lost or you won. You know, as your colleague Joanne Reed would say, here on Earth One, those are the only two options. But on Earth Two, you know, there's another option, which is if I fight it long enough, if I shout about the big lie long enough, I might eventually find a judge like you were just talking about who will agree with me and who will overturn an election the same way you have a judge overturning drop boxes, even though there's nothing that says that they can't use drop boxes. And so that's the reality that we're up against. All we can do is continue to speak the truth, to point out, you know, all the many examples of the impact that the voter suppression is having, and just having honest conversations with our community and fighting for a protective framework in terms of voting rights legislation. That's what we need at this moment.
Cliff, what does that fight look like if everybody, regardless of party affiliation and news organization, seems to see that the writing's on the wall for federal voting rights legislation with Senator Sinema and Manchin uninterested in a carve out for the filibuster to protect elections and protect democracy? What is the next, what is sort of dusting yourself up, off and getting up the day after that vote fails look like?
Yeah, I mean, it's a couple of things. One, I think we need to let the process play out, right? Because at the end of the day, Senator Sinema can give a speech. Joe Manchin can do a gaggle and talk about how he doesn't want to end the filibuster. He can issue a memo. But at the end of the day, they're in the Senate to vote, right? They're in the Senate. We call it the world's most deliberative body. Well, then they need to deliberate. Like, there needs to be a debate on this. And it's one thing when you're just giving a speech or sending a memo. It's another thing when you've got to stand on that Senate floor and debate it along against some of your colleagues, right? They've never really had to have that good give and take. They can usually just issue their sentences and move on. And so the process has to move on. There's going to be a debate both about the bill as well as a vote on the bill, and then eventually a debate and a vote on the filibuster rules. And it's one thing to say that you're not going to do it, but Senator Sinema is going to have to stand in that gallery. She's got to stand on the floor in a week that where we celebrate Dr. King and vote against a bill that is named after somebody that she refers to as a mentor and a hero. So the process needs to go on. And then we who are on the outside need to do and continue to do our jobs, which is to push and to advocate the same way that folks in 1965 had to advocate and push President Johnson to do the right thing in terms of the Voting Rights Act. That's why we're actually going to be revisiting our corporate accountability campaign that we did in Georgia early last year and talk to some donors to Senator Sinema, asking her or asking them to ask her to do the right thing.
And just to bring it back, Nick, to the reporting that sort of open people's eyes to just how bad the Georgia law was. It did result in the kind of boycotts that got attention from baseball. They moved that game. But, then we moved to Texas, and their law also got a lot of attention when the Democrats in the legislature fled. They left, denying the Republicans a quorum. But it feels like after that, when the efforts to stop these bills failed, the next 17 seem to sail right through. Tell me what this front looks like coming into the second year of dozens and dozens and dozens of bills still before state legislatures.
Yeah, well, I think just looking at the amount of public outcry that met the Georgia law, that met the Texas law, I mean, there were Texas businesses that are anchors of that state, Dell, American Airlines, that came out very forcefully against the initial bills. And then they kind of receded into the background, and, they were threatened with losing some tax subsidies. And so I think it just became, for a lot of these corporations that were pushing back, not worth it. And once the Texas bill, passed, and after the third attempt, I think, and other states were moving ahead, the voting rights battle kind of receded, I think, from some national attention, in part also because President Biden was focusing on infrastructure and Build Back Better. And that was taking up a lot of the attention. So as we gear up for yet another year, there's dozens of bills. In fact, it's over 100 that are either retained or carry over into the next year. And some are going to be in pretty critical states for the midterms. In New Hampshire, for example, there's a couple bills that have either already been pre-filed, one asking for a complete hand count of elections, which would lead to extremely delayed results and other problems that could kind of be exacerbated in an unknown period after elections. But there's also the possibility of bringing back a bill targeting students and trying to challenge them on what constitutes a residency. In Florida, we've seen Governor Ron DeSantis, who's looking to pump up his national reputation, especially among the base, has really made voting core to his new push to get more attention. And so he's looking for an election task force that's going to have the heft of law enforcement behind it. He's looking to ban outside funding so that organizations such as one funded by Mark Zuckerberg can't help local election officials pay for machines or pay for PPE for their election workers. So if you look at where states are going to be voting in the midterms, there's going to be, I think, a significant amount of new voting legislation that seeks to kind of tip the scales a little bit. And then, as was mentioned earlier, this has just become so core to the Republican base. And the reason that the top Republican in the Georgia Senate is going for this is to play to that base and to propose getting rid of drop boxes. So I think in other red states, we're going to continue to see new laws as well.
Greg, really quickly, do you think with the law in place that President Biden and the two Democratic senators, Warnock and Ossoff, would have prevailed?
Oh, that's a really good question. We definitely saw a sharp drop off in ballot drop box usage in the municipal elections from last year because it limits the use of those. So that alone would have significantly impacted Democratic turnout because Democrats were the vast recipients, the vast users of those ballot drop boxes. So it's hard to say precisely, but it certainly would have affected overall turnout.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the whole ballgame for the Republican Party. We'll watch this space. Nick Corsenetti, Greg Bluestein, Cliff Albright, thank you so much for starting us off this hour. Great to see all of you. When we come back, a dire warning from our closest ally about the perilous state of American democracy and the nightmare scenario that we could be facing sooner than any of us think. Plus, why more and more schools are moving to virtual amid the current COVID surge. Even New York's mayor says he's now considering a temporary remote option as rising student and teacher absences make in-person learning a challenge. And with days before the start of the Australian Open, it's likely just a matter of time before tennis superstar Novak Djokovic gets thrown out of that country for not being vaccinated. Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
The goal of the former president's allies is to disenfranchise anyone who votes against them. Simple as that. The facts won't matter. Your vote won't matter. They'll just decide what they want and then do it. That's the kind of power you see in totalitarian states, not in democracies. We must be vigilant, and the world is watching. I know the majority of the world leaders, the good and the bad ones, adversaries and allies alike, they're watching American democracy and seeing whether we can meet this moment. And that's not hyperbole.
President Joe Biden on Tuesday telling Americans, quote, the world is watching as one of the country's two major political parties turns its back on democracy and democratic norms, using the big lie to fuel a slow motion insurrection through voter suppression and a push to take over the institutions that run our elections. The president is right that the world is watching. The world is very worried about what it sees. A professor in Canada taking a cue from experts in America who are warning of a constitutional crisis is out with a dire warning for his fellow Canadians, urging them to prepare for the possibility of civil war in the United States. He writes this, quote, by 2025, American democracy could collapse, causing extreme domestic political instability, including widespread civil violence. By 2030, if not sooner, the country could be governed by a right-wing dictatorship. We mustn't dismiss these possibilities just because they seem ludicrous or too horrible to imagine. In 2014, the suggestion that Donald Trump would become president would also have struck nearly everyone as absurd. But today, we live in a world where the absurd regularly becomes real and the horrible commonplace. Joining us now is the author of the dire warning, Thomas Hummer Dixon, Canadian political scientist and executive director at the Cascade Institute at Royal Roads University. We've been wanting to have this conversation for days. Thank you so much for spending some time with us. And we are so self-absorbed. We don't, that's not really a partisan observation. It's just the fact of our nature. But tell me how Canadians view America right now.
We view America with enormous concern and worry, as does much of the world, really. But also, I think, with anguish, because we are friends of America. Many of us have spent much of our lives in America. I spent many years in graduate school in the United States. And our associations, of course, are very strong going back centuries. The relationship has sometimes been strained, but for the most part, We've been very good neighbors with each other. And to see the kind of trauma that the United States is experiencing right now and the dangers to its democracy are not just worrying in terms of our concerns for our own well-being as a country, but also it's like seeing a friend in grave crisis. And that's hard for us. It's emotionally challenging.
What preparations would you guess the Canadian government is taking and frankly, other allies for this scenario that Donald Trump or one of his acolytes reclaim the presidency or don't and say they did? We're certainly moving toward a place where you have to examine that as possible. What are the preparations to either fill the vacuum or deal with an America that is not an example of democratic sort of example for anything?
A stable democratic regime, that's right. So I would say that actually there's been very little preparation so far, at least certainly in Canada. That whole set of scenarios that I described in my piece and that other people have described seems in some sense so outlandish, almost unimaginable, that we've and so deeply disturbing to what it means to be Canada and to be safe and secure in Canada, that we have simply not thought about it very much. So the point of my piece in the Globe and Mail, which seems to have struck quite a chord, not just mm-hmm. in Canada, but around the world, it was to just sort of pull back the curtains and say, hey, we have a problem here. We need to at first have a very clear assessment of the dangers to the South. Now, things may turn out fine. There is enormous resilience in American society and its culture and institutions. But as a political scientist and as working closely with other political scientists who study state breakdown and the sources of civil violence within societies, there are a lot of warning signals. And we need to start heeding those warning signals now. So the first step is to start the conversation in Canada. And the next step would then be to think in concrete ways about how we can buffer ourselves from that trauma and perhaps even help in some way to be decided. We have to be careful that we're not accused of interfering in American affairs. But there are some 750,000 Canadian emigres in the United States, and certain segments of the American population look to Canada as a place that seems more or less to have its act together. So maybe there's some things we can do on the sidelines, at least to root for the continuation of a robust democracy within the United States and make that more possible.
What are the institutions that have been, in your view, most weakened, and the weakening of which institutions worries you the most?
So that's a very good question. I would say the kind of gridlock we're seeing in Congress, and it sometimes seems that the country is almost ungovernable. Now, the checks and balances in the American political system are intended, in a sense, to weaken state power. But in times of crisis like this, when there needs to be some aggressive attempts to protect, for instance, voting rights and the electoral system at the state level, the inability of the institutions to respond to protect those democratic mechanisms is really of concern. I would say the thing that actually concerns me most is less institutional and more a kind of belief system or ideological issue, and that is the poison of the big lie, the falsehood that Mr. Trump won the last election when he actually lost it. That poison has propagated widely through the body politic in the United States. So somewhere between 30 and 40% of the American electorate now believes that the last election was stolen and President Biden is an illegitimate president. It's going to be very difficult for those people to accept the results of any election in the future that doesn't produce a result that they desire, that they want. And in that kind of situation where you have a very large chunk of a population that's just unwilling to concede that they lost, a democracy doesn't work, as I point out in my article. And I think that is that big lie, that falsehood, is enormously damaging. And the fact that so many people accept it in the United States is very worrisome.
Yeah, I mean, we contend with that every day. I have an audience that is rooted in the facts and reality, and we cover the big lie and the damage it does to democracy. But there are other networks in this country, as I'm sure you're aware of, that you write about, whose audience does believe the lie, and they spend no time taking apart or showing their viewers the evidence that it is not rooted in fact. So you've diagnosed the problem. I hope we can continue to call on you to help figure out some solutions. Thomas Homer Dixon, thank you so much for spending some time with us, and thank you for the piece that you wrote. It certainly did strike a nerve and start a conversation. We've talked about it every day since it came out. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, even though doctors say schools are the safest places for kids, some parents and some teachers and some students have real concerns about this latest COVID surge. We'll talk through all the facts with our medical experts next. Stay with us.
Schools are not closing. Let's be very clear on that. We are not closing our schools. This is not Chicago. We are working with the UFT. It is as though people are disappointed that I'm able to sit down and have conversations with each other. I said I was going to do this as mayor. We are having great conversations, and we are working together to get our children educated in a safe way.
It's New York City's new mayor, Eric Adams, unchanged in his position that schools are staying open and that they are the safest place for kids. But Mayor Adams says he is working with the teachers union to address COVID concerns among teachers as well as parents who are choosing not to take their kids to school. About one fourth or 225,000 of the city's students stayed home this week. One discussion on the table, he says, is a temporary remote option for those students. Also today, students in Boston walked out of their classrooms demanding a remote learning option and stronger safety measures, as did students in Chicago after returning to class just 2 days ago, demanding the district provide them with more masks and resources and include them in ongoing negotiations between the schools and the teachers. Let's bring in NBC News correspondent Shaq Brewster, live for us in Chicago, and Dr. Peter Hotez, co-director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital and dean of the School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College. Dr. Hotez, we haven't had a chance to talk to you in a while. It's great to see you. What is your view about where the science is right now amid this Omicron surge in cases?
Well, you know, this is the problem, Nicole. We're not really hearing from Washington or Atlanta what the science says. And so we're making or forcing educators and school administrators, in some cases city leaders, to become the public health experts and make that decision. And they just don't have the background information to know what to do. I mean, point one, I think everybody agrees kids should be in school. And we heard from the Surgeon General at the end of last year about the mental health effects of not having kids in school, much, and also the importance of getting mental health counseling in school and getting nutrition in some inner cities for kids or in rural areas. So everybody gets that. But what's not done is to give a frank accounting of what this Omicron epidemic is all about. First of all, how long is it going to last? Would there be benefit in just delaying it another 2 weeks in order to, while there's the screaming level of transmission, and being able to make it up in the summer or at the back end of the school year so that the length of time the kids in school doesn't change? Point one. Point two, we know what the risk of hospitalization and death is, but what we don't hear is what the risk of the more subtle morbidities are. What about long COVID? The Great Ormond Street Hospital in London just came out with information saying that 1 in 7 kids could develop long COVID. What does that mean for their long-term neurodevelopment? What does the science say about potential modest neurologic impairments for certain populations of kids? What about the findings of increased rates of diabetes? Parents should know that and be able to make intelligent decisions to say, well, okay, if we need to have kids in schools, we get that, but would there be benefit of delaying it a week or two? Instead, you know, what we get from the CDC, the White House, what we get from our school administrators, like you just heard, is baby talk. And the baby talk says, of course, we're going to keep our kids in school. Well, it's not adequate. Parents want to know information to make the best decision for their kids.
I have followed kids and COVID very closely because I have a kid. And I think a lot of parents have struggled with all that you just laid out there, Dr. Hotez. only 25% of kids 5 to 11 are vaccinated. I think about 53% of kids under 18 are vaccinated. My sense of the hospitalized children is that in New York, two are vaccinated. Very, very, very small numbers of kids have reported symptoms of long COVID, and almost none are hospitalized. Why not a bigger push on vaccinating kids?
Well, you're absolutely right. And again, part of that goes to we've not had adequate messaging what the health risks to the kids are. We keep hearing about relatively small numbers of deaths. Well, first of all, they're not that small. In many cases, they're greater than what it is for influenza. But again, we don't hear about the fact that we don't want kids to get COVID. And potentially, if it is really one in seven for some variants, maybe not as much for Omicron, what that means and diabetes and everything else. So we don't give parents the information they need to make adequate risk assessments and the urgency for getting kids vaccinated. And the consequences of that are vary by region. So we're about 75% of the teenagers in the north, half that in the south. So we're doing a terrible job vaccinating kids in the southern teenagers in the southern states and in Texas. And then among the little kids, 5 to 11, we're looking at 15% vaccination rates. So there's a lot we can do to mitigate against this, but this all has to be kind of laid out in a very synthesized way for parents. And instead, what we're hearing are little snippets and sound bites and trite sayings, when what we really need is an educated individual to really spell this out in detail so parents can understand it.
In fairness to the Biden administration, Shaq, the First Lady and the president spend a lot of time on the facts. And I think what Dr. Hodes is speaking to is this patchwork system that has sprouted up as we head into our third year of the pandemic. And you're on the ground in Chicago. Tell me what's happening there.
Well, what you really saw was a boiling over, and that boiling over extending to the students here in Chicago public school system. If you look back at the past week, the past 2 weeks, students have been looking at the city officials of Chicago and Chicago's teachers union going back and forth. It led to that standoff that led to 5 days of canceled in-person and virtual instruction. And then students returned to the classroom this week, but they said that their concerns were not being addressed in that agreement between the city officials and the teachers union. So they staged a walkout, and you saw a walkout like what we had in Chicago play out in other cities, yesterday in Brooklyn, New York, earlier today in Boston, Massachusetts as well. So the students saying that they wanted their voices included in that, and that they have concerns, they have their own demands that they want to be heard and addressed. I want you to listen to a bit of my conversation with one of the organizers, the main organizer of this walkout, where we saw about several hundred students come to the Chicago Public School headquarters. She's 14 years old, organizes gathering. Listen to why she said she did this. That agreement that was reached between CTU and city officials, were you happy with that or were you not?
No, that was the bare minimum. And the fact that we even had to fight for safety within our schools, that's insane. It's insane to me. Why do we have to ask for COVID testing in the middle of the pandemic? Why do we have to ask that our teachers are provided with masks? These are, and it's not an impossible thing either. We've seen this happen in other school districts.
Nicole, I think you hear the frustration in her voice there. That frustration extended to many of the students that were here. But there's another point that I heard in my conversations with them, and it's the sense of fear that some of them have. One group told me that they're not just scared of contracting the virus, but of bringing it home to others. One person mentioned he had a sister, a sibling with asthma. Another mentioned a parent with a heart condition. There's a fear that if this is not controlled, as they're watching cases surge, as they know more and more kids, other teachers that are contracting this virus, there's a fear that they bring that home. One person said he thinks about it every time he walks into the school, and he fears that every time he walks into a school building. You just get a sense of how difficult it is managing this pandemic and how many people are at stake and how many stakeholders there are in this process, Nicole.
Shaq, were any of the students you talked to vaccinated?
Some of them were, and that, you know, is something that you heard from city officials when they were reopening schools and planning the reopening. They were talking about the vaccinations and pushing the vaccinations. Part of the demands that these students had, and it was an extensive list of demands that they have, but one of the demands on their list was making vaccines more available, opening up more vaccination clinics inside some of the schools. So yes, there were some vaccines there. I didn't have that conversation with every individual student, but they did, and if you look at that list of demands, they did emphasize the importance of vaccinations. One of the other demands, they not only want masks available, but they want K95 masks available for all students and staff. There's that sense that they want more resources, and included in that are those vaccinations.
NBC Shaq Brewster, thank you so much for your reporting there. Dr. Hotez sticks around. A quick break for us. When we come back, a new twist in the saga of tennis superstar Novak Djokovic, whose refusal to get vaccinated against COVID has run headfirst into a country trying to do the right thing and keeping its citizens safe. That report is next. After a full week of tension and buildup, the statement today from Australia's immigration minister reads, quote, "Today I exercise my power under Section 133C3 of the Migration Act to cancel the visa held by Mr. Novak Djokovic on health and good order grounds on the basis that it was in the public interest to do so." In other words, short of winning a last-ditch appeal set to be heard on Sunday, the number one men's tennis player on planet Earth has been instructed to essentially scram to leave Australia. If you've been following along with us this week, you'll already be aware Australian border officials first revoked his visa when he arrived in Melbourne, rejecting his claim of a medical exemption based on a prior positive test. Djokovic won the appeal and was poised to compete for a record 21st major title at the Australian Open starting Monday. But as we reported, the government official with the power to do so has canceled that visa again, meaning that Djokovic, the main draw for this year's tournament, could very well soon be deported. Joining our conversation, veteran sports columnist Mike Lupica, a member of the National Sports Media Association Hall of Fame, and the co-author, along with James Patterson, of the new novel, The Horsewoman, which is getting terrific reviews and making its way up the bestseller list. Dr. Hotez is still with us. Mike Lupica, you're going to come back and we'll talk about novel writing with James Patterson. That's amazing. And of course, that's the plot twist that you brought us today. But I want to ask you about tennis. Why did tennis get rid of Djokovic?
You know what, Nicole? He was trying to win his 21st major at this Australian Open, but having your visa revoked twice before a major championship even starts, to me, is a new world's record for him. I have no sympathy for him. Martina Navratilova said something today that I said last night before this all came down, which was, if he had any good grace and he had any respect for a tournament he has won 9 times, he would pack up, withdraw, and get out of the country before they throw him out of the country. I don't know how he thought this was going to work out. And the Tennis Australia officials, they are complicit in this. But ultimately, this is on him. Even as anti-vax people try to turn him into some sort of Nelson Mandela. No, he's pig-headed. He's stubborn. And what has happened here with the immigration minister, Alex Hawk, is this, Nicole. Somebody finally said no to Novak Djokovic. He should have learned his lesson when he hit a lineswoman in the neck with a ball and got bounced from the U.S. Open, that sometimes rules are still rules, even if you're the number one player in the world.
You know, Dr. Hotez, why does this matter? What does it matter what a famous tennis player does? It matters because of what you just said in the last block. We don't know what's going to happen to kids that get COVID. It matters what people in the public eye do when it comes to protecting themselves, protecting their fans, and protecting their fans in another country.
Well, it also matters, Nicole, and as you know, I absolutely agree with what Mike says. I mean, what the problem is when a high-profile athlete espouses anti-vaccine views, unfortunately and unfairly, it becomes the face of the sport. So for most of this fall, Aaron Rodgers became the face of the NFL, the National Football League, by refusing to vaccinate and said he was a critical thinker because of it. And Kyrie Irving became the face of the National Basketball Association. And now this for tennis. And it's unfair because the truth is the leagues are actually working pretty hard to encourage athletes to get vaccinated. And their vaccination rates are actually quite good in all of those sports I just talked about. And they are trying to put faces out there. But the problem is the highest profile players are espousing anti-vaccine views, and they are role models, and they are encouraging a generation of young people not to get vaccinated as a consequence. And that's the damage this does.
So, Mike Lupica, why do the leagues who've done all this hard work, who have brought along big stars, let some of the biggest, most elite superstars get away with not following the rules?
Because the rules change, Nicole, from sport to sport. Kyrie Irving can't play home games because of the rules in New York City. So he's playing half his team's game. Rodgers, because of the rules of the NFL and because he did test positive, he gets to continue to play in the National Football League. And tennis has always been like the wild, wild west. French Open says one thing. Wimbledon says another. The U.S. Open says another. But Australia, and even though their politicians haven't always covered themselves in glory on this thing, they're on the right side of this thing. Doc, I was saying to my kids the other day that anti-vaxxing becoming a political position is the dumbest thing that has happened in my adult lifetime in this country. It's not about politics. It's about science. It's about making the world more safe, one person at a time. But Djokovic can't get out of his own way. And Nicole and Doc, here's the thing about him. This guy is so desperate to be loved. And I don't think he is able to take a step back and understand the damage, the lasting damage he is doing to his own brand and his own legacy, and also to this tournament that he says he reveres.
Mike's new book is out. It's called The Horsewoman. I'm going to pick it up this weekend. Mike Lupica, Dr. Peter Hotez, thank you so much for spending some time with us. A quick break for us. We'll be right back. Okay, so the next time the cashier hands you your change, take a close look at your quarters, and you just might be lucky enough to find Maya Angelou staring back at you on the tail side. She, of course, is an American treasure, an all-time brilliant writer and poet, and now she is the first Black woman to have her likeness on a quarter. The U.S. Mint says the commemorative coins began shipping this week, part of a four-year series honoring a number of women whose lives have changed the world. Maya Angelou once described her mission in life this way, quote, "not merely to survive, but to thrive, and to do so with some passion, some compassion, some humor, and some style." Oh boy, did she ever. Quick break for us. We'll be right back. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes for another week of shows during these extraordinary times. We are so grateful.